Media shouldn't be one note. Support Rabble.ca and a diversity of voices in Canadian media. Visit rabble.ca/donate to contribute.
This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face. So my next interview is about a film called Werewolf. This is a Canadian production coming out. Built and created and written and filmed on a micro budget. And Ashley McKenzie is the director and the writer, and she's going to tell us about the collaborative nature of how she works and how she approaches not only her crew and her actors, but also just the community that she's developed on her sets. This is a really interesting film. It's gonna play with your senses a little bit. It's dare I say, I hope this is okay, Ashley, but it's postmodern. It steps outside of certainly what I'm used to stylistically, and I think really helps to not only move the story forward, but helps to disrupt and to sort of penetrate a little bit deeper than your average sort of narrative filmmaking. And I think it's about really, in some senses, paying attention. And there, for me, this film just appealed on so many levels because of its philosophical edge and its relational edge. And I'm not going to say much more other than you need to check it out. If you're a fan of film, if you're a fan of philosophy, if you're a fan of relationships and of fighting back, then you need to see Werewolf. Interview with Ashley McKenzie coming right up. DavidPeckLive.com for more TIFF interviews, more interviews as a whole. We're probably close to 230, 240 now. Rabble.ca, you can check us out there as well online. Ashley McKenzie, and the film is Werewolf. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by another special guest here live at the Toronto International Film Festival 2016. Filmmaker Ashley McKenzie is with us here today to talk about her film, Werewolf, world premiere. Ashley, thanks for your time. It's a little early to be sitting in a bar without any alcohol, frankly.
That's true. Yeah. I haven't even had coffee.
I think we should line a few shots up on the bar over there. We're somewhere here in Toronto on Peter Street. Yeah. Thanks a lot for your time. Really appreciate it.
Yeah,
so
thanks.
You must be kind of buzzing.
Yeah.
The premiere was last night?
Yeah, I'm still buzzing for sure. It's overwhelming.
So how did you feel? I was at the theater, attended the Q&A. How did you feel walking out? And you're not a stranger to the film festival, right?
I've had two of my shorts played here, and I came and did the Talent Lab in 2012. And TIFF also does a top 10 list every year, Canada's top 10, and my first short film played on that. So yeah, I feel like I've been back here several times, but this feels different. Having a feature feels very different.
Yeah. I bet there's a little bit more of a metaphorical red carpet-like edge to it.
Yeah, and just a lot of, I guess, the business side of filmmaking.
Right.
Yeah, you're not exposed to it as much in the short film world. You're in a bit of a bubble, but now it's like, okay, feature films are products, or people are interested in you know, distributing them and selling them.
And is that something that, as a filmmaker, you're just going to say, yeah, you know what, talk to the producer, or, you know, here's the number of the person to call?
Yeah, I would like to do that, but I'm the co-producer, so what I want to do, but then I'm like, oh yeah, I got to make these decisions.
Kind of falls on you, too.
Yeah.
So I'm fascinated by a question last night in the audience about the micro-budget side of things that maybe we can talk about, because it's just really interesting, I think, too, and a real inspiration to other filmmakers to be able to make something that can actually get to a festival, get to this level. I don't even know what a micro budget means, but maybe we can start there.
Yeah.
Why don't we?
Yeah, at least in Canada, I know a micro budget means a film made for less than $250,000. At least according to our funders, that's what it means. Like with the Arts Council, if you make a, yeah, you can't really get Arts Council funding and go have a budget of more than $250,000.
Are you allowed to raise other money as well?
No, that's their cap. Like, say for us with the Arts Council, they gave us, the Canada Council for the Arts gave us $60,000, but if our budget could not exceed $250,000.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. I see what you mean. Yeah. Right. Okay. And
And same with Telefilm, our other funder. You know, according to their regulations of in the micro budget program, they gave us $120,000, and we could raise up to $250,000.
Oh, I misunderstood. So they're not so generous that they gave you the $250,000.
No.
You're capped at $250,000.
Yeah, you're capped.
And we'll give you $60,000 or whatever to help along the way.
Yeah. So we had four funders.
And is it that hard to make a film like Werewolf for under $250,000?
It seems like it's always hard, but honestly, I think that we sort of felt like it would be more advantageous for us to not try to be bigger, because usually the bigger you get, the more people you need to answer to, the more insurance you need, and the more lawyers you need, and bankers, and that ends up being more work. So in some ways, we're trying to find the middle ground where you have enough money to make the film, but not so much that you end up doing more paperwork.
I got a real, real grassroots, real organic feel. I mean, no kidding. I'm going to tell my listeners, you're sitting behind a sign that says Train Spotting, and it is funny. How could that film not come to mind? You know, watching your film last night and several others too. You know, Sid and Nancy crossed my mind.
Okay.
Pi, Darren Aronofsky crossed my mind. You know, Requiem for a Dream. You know, there's others that sense of almost despair and meaninglessness of it all, and the fact that and maybe you need to we're in already, but the film is Werewolf, and congratulations, by the way.
Thanks.
It's I'm feeling a bit of the buzz myself for you guys as I'm doing these interviews. It's pretty fun. It's pretty amazing. But my background is philosophy academically, and so I couldn't help but go to that sort of postmodern feel, not only about the story and the narrative and the characters and their outlook on life, these drug addicts trying to heal, but also your style. You know, there was this sense of geometry sort of to it, yet really disruptive. So the photo, the frame was, it was framed, but it was off-frame.
Yeah.
It was disconcerting, you know, philosophically, ideologically. And on the drive-in this morning, I thought, this is a film that's actually going to stick with me because of that.
Okay,
which I think is fascinating.
Hmm. Yeah, I think on the big screen that feeling plays much more than I realized, I guess, because I've just been in finishing the film scene and on smaller screens.
Right,
and
right.
Me and a few of my collaborators were talking last night. We're like, whoa, yeah, some of those framings or some of those shots, they are quite disorientating when it's on a big screen.
Very unsettling.
Yeah.
I mean, was that in... obviously these were intentional choices as a filmmaker, but was that your intent to disrupt the audience that much?
I wasn't consciously thinking I want to disrupt the audience, or I want them to feel uneasy with this framing or anything like that necessarily. It was more just an instinctual choice that I was just trying to find the framing that seemed to say something, or did, I guess, have an emotion to it, but I wasn't, you know, I wasn't really trying to necessarily get under people's skin or have this effect. I just wanted to find the most honest framing, and I just didn't. I know in choosing not to do a classical, to frame the film classically, that it's gonna disrupt. I guess naturally it's going to, right?
Of course.
You're not gonna. That's what classical filmmaking's all about. It's about not, no disruptions. Everything just coming to you very easily. And
Are you a protester and an activist by nature?
No.
You seem pretty quiet, pretty understated in the Q&A. All of you did, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, in the Q&A. And I just thought, this is a pretty disruptive film. For me, anyway. I don't know about
for
others.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. No, I'm definitely not I'm a pretty quiet person. And I think, my artistic choices in the film, I think they just felt like simple, honest choices, too. I didn't have a big agenda or anything like that. I think I was just trying to trust my gut and just do what felt right to my taste and what seemed interesting to me and what seemed powerful to me and what seemed aesthetically pleasing to me.
And did you
know
those
things? Yeah, that's kind of strange, because I'm like, that stuff actually felt, that's what felt aesthetically pleasing to me.
Mm.
But it's actually, I guess in a lot of ways.
Well, really, it really aligns, in my mind, it aligns with the content too, right, to the narrative and the storytelling itself, and how how this relationship unfolds. I think it really is quite postmodern in its own, and quite, I mean, there's a despair to it, right? An existential despair to it, and yet philosophically, I think that's really apparent and yet quite hopeful as well, really understated. And yet I have to say, I was really, I wanted to step into the screen and get Vanessa to smile. Like, I just wanted to stand up. How can I help?
Yeah, that's true. It was funny, last night we were talking about one of my favorite films is by the Dardenne brothers, Rosetta. And I was talking to someone last night about how I had given Bria the film, who plays Nessa, because she was a theater actress. And I just thought, you know, this is her first time doing a film. And I was just like, I'm just going to send her a few films that I think just to get give her a sense of what I feel like this film will be like as far as performances. And in the film Rosetta, the main character, who's like sort of the similar age to Nessa, is so understated. And for me, the climax of the film is she cracks the tiniest smile. And for me, that's the climax. But yeah, it's true that Nessa doesn't really crack even that subtle smile in the film. That doesn't happen. So
would you say, I don't know how many interviews you've done about the film and how much sort of, you know, reflection post now screening is what, 12 hours, not even 10 hours. What's the film about? I mean, werewolf, question mark. You know, you made a very interesting comment last night. You said this film has touched pretty much all of us in its own way. And that got my attention. You dedicate it to somebody at the end. Is this film about addiction? Is this film about mental health issues? Is it about relationships? Is it about poverty? I mean, it's about all those things, it seems to me, but love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, I think it's about all those things, but the film, I'm just realizing what it's about now, but for me, I think it can be each of the things you just named to different people. I think that for me, it's a lot of it has become a relationship film, because on a personal level, like, I've sort of gone through that. I was in a relationship for years with someone who was my best friend, but the relationship became very toxic, and then so then severing that bond was probably like the hardest thing I had to do. And I think that's when I watch the film now, that's what I feel with Nessa and Blaze. I feel like, oh, it feels like my life in some ways.
Wow.
I'm watching on the screen.
So almost autobiographical in a way.
In a way, but wasn't conscious. You know, I knew I was putting some of that stuff in there, but it wasn't until like a few weeks ago in sound design where I was sitting back and watching it that I saw it for the first time, I felt like. But yeah, the film is dedicated to Mess Folk, which is a band that a friend of mine was in. And that friend is someone who I started to write the character of Blaze for him to play. Because, he was a friend of mine in Cape Breton, and I was moving home to Cape Breton, and he was always telling me, you know, will you put me in a film? And I was like, at the time, the film I was working on, it didn't have a role that was appropriate. But when I moved home to Cape Breton, I thought, oh, okay, no, I think this, you know, film werewolf, I think that he could act in this. And the character, I think, is someone he will really relate to, because a lot of people back home, a lot of young people are struggling with some of the issues you're talking about, mental health, feeling trapped, depression, unemployment, addiction. And so, yeah, I started to write it for him, but within a few months, like, he had committed suicide, and that, for me, just cemented needing to make the film, because it felt like, no, these issues that I'm starting to explore, they just sort of exploded in that moment, and it just touched me closer than I'd already just,
of course,
being in that community, those issues were all very close, but then all of a sudden it just became so personal, and it just felt like this, you know, a subject matter I had to explore at that time. So that's, I think, what I mean by I was touched personally by it, because Andrew, who plays Blaze, was also a good friend of my friend Phil, who's in Mess Folk. So, yeah, it was a personal...
I'm not supposed to like Blaze, am I? I'm not sure what to do with Blaze. I mean, my heart went out to him in so many scenes, right? And there is a bit of tension there between, for the love, would you look what this woman is doing on your behalf and for you, and the generosity and the grace. And on some level, you got to think, it was getting through. At least I mean, ultimately, at the end of the day, I got to try to remain hopeful.
Yeah.
And I think your film does that too, which is really remarkable in such a what appears to be a dark world on the surface.
Yeah, yeah, I think with my characters, I don't try to make them likable or unlikable.
Right.
I just try to make them be what they are, and
right.
how that comes off. I'll find out about it afterwards when people start talking to me, and for sure people are like, Blaze, I just wanted to step in there and strangle a guy, and other people are like, I related to how so much to how messed up he was, and I feel so sad for how self-destructive he is. And
well, I hope people go on to see the film and talk about some of the issues that you're raising, because I think, I mean, I'm doing a little bit of work on PTSD right now and
okay.
mental health issues
mm.
and in relation to Southeast Asia and Cambodia and the Civil War and so on.
Yeah.
And just seeing how little's being done around it, never
yeah.
mind in that part of the world.
Yeah.
And even here, I mean,
yeah.
some of these issues, we're kind of still afraid to talk about them
yeah.
in some respects, right? It's a little too vulnerable.
Yeah.
Don't get too close, right?
Yeah.
We're all kind of Blaze in some way, right?
Yeah. No, it's so true, and I think making this film was definitely a mission. Like my friend who I mentioned, Phil, who the film is dedicated to, what I loved about him is he was so candid, him
mm.
and his brother, and mm. his brother also took his own life. So
mm.
they were both artists and both just very interesting young people, and they were so candid about their struggles, you know, with mental health and with the law, and with, they spoke out about it so much, and that really ruffled people's feathers, and they were sort of provocative guys in the community because of that. But making the film, I just respected that so much and always thought about, no, someone, like, we just need to talk about it. Let's just talk.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
silence, for me, just is really isolating.
Silence, well, too often it seems to me, it's not the answer, but it certainly seems to be what so many of us turn to relationally when it comes to the work. Workplace bullying. Have you ever heard of it? I hadn't until recently, and it's becoming a huge issue, but of course people don't want to talk about it because there's fear and anxiety and guilt and all these things,
mm-hmm.
right? But it seems to, what, I mean, I've, of 25 years now, I've said, you know, what is it? We're not supposed to talk about sex, religion, and politics, and I've added death to that.
Mm.
And then said, hang on, those are the four things we should be talking about.
That's the stuff of life. Why
it's
aren't we talking about that?
Connected.
Yeah.
So, okay, so have you read much existentialism?
In university a bit, but it's been a while.
So I found the scene with the lawnmower up the gravel hill to the camper. I just went to Camus.
Yes, okay, yeah, for
like
sure.
immediately to Camus.
Yeah.
Like, this is
okay,
their lives.
Good.
It
yeah.
doesn't get, I mean, I'm getting goosebumps even. It just, it does, and this is, for me, is the trap of it. When I want to start going, oh, come on, Blaze, you need to be responsible. You need to make better choices.
Yeah.
I think when you see that, you start to get a sense for that and intuitively feel it as maybe it moves the needle a little bit when it comes to empathy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, no, it's interesting because...
And gravel, too. The sound is actually irritating.
Yeah.
Like, the sound got to
me. Yeah, it's abrasive.
It really is.
Yeah, it's abrasive. But yeah, I know that there's a definite Sisyphean thing going on, and actually... Years ago, I just remember when you brought this up, I wanted to name my production company. Before, it's called Grassfire Films, but what I was going to name it was Pivot Pictures, because I had a philosophy professor who talked, he had this theory of basically finding hope in the myth of Sisyphus, which was that when you like walk up to the top of the hill, he described that when the boulder rolls back down, that the step you take backwards, this one step back, this pivot, he described it, as within that pivot that there is space there to sort of have hope or to have some consciousness of the situation that you can maybe make a choice on how you feel about basically this deterministic scenario that you're stuck in.
And for our listeners, Sisyphus, the Greek myth, Albert Camus retells it, starts this short essay, the most important question is suicide.
Mm-hmm.
If the world
yes.
is meaningless, if
yeah.
things are truly meaningless, then
yeah.
the most important question is,
yeah.
why not
whether
suicide?
Or not to kill yourself,
and then goes
yeah.
on to tell the myth of rolling a boulder up a hill, and then it falls down again, and you got to go back.
Yeah.
And so it's finding meaning in the meaninglessness. So your prof says, you turn around to take the step back to go get the boulder, that's where the hope is.
Yeah.
That arc of, or whatever.
Yeah, there's this minute,
interesting.
Yeah, space in your pivot backwards that you can...
How do you get through to somebody like your friends and communicate to them that, you know, your friend Phil, for instance, at some point, obviously, the despair trumped the hope, I guess you could say, in a sense. And, well, most of us probably get there at one time or another, but maybe not. Maybe not.
Yeah, it's... I don't know. That's a question I don't feel like I can really answer.
I don't know if there is one, really.
No, it's so hard to understand, I think, how the moments where people do feel like that there's a, you know, there's a reason to be here and life is good, and the moments where people feel like it's, there's nothing, that, you know, you make a choice to commit suicide, that question. I mean, my friend Phil really liked Camus as well, and like, I don't know, you talk about these issues and it's like, you know, you read a text that's about it, but it's like when you're actually living it, then it doesn't make sense to me anymore.
For me, you know, everything comes back to relationship, and not at the risk of sounding trite, everything comes back to relationship. Everything comes back to bonding. And in a film, Marie Curie, that I saw yesterday as well, there's a great line by Marie Curie's character, and she said, life is trivial if you don't do it together, basically.
The physicist?
That's right, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
There's a film with her.
Yeah,
interesting.
Yeah, The Courage of Knowledge is the subtitle. It's wonderful, really beautiful film. Marie Noël is the director. And so for her, I mean, it's really this great scientific metaphor of the parts, but we got to do this together. We're in this together. And there's a couple scenes in your film that are really difficult to watch where they're trying, in a sense, to reach out to the community, to offer their services, to cut lawns, and people are just entirely shutting them down. Mm-hmm. And it's heartbreaking to think, you know, I mean, I couldn't help but say, have I, am I behaved that way? Mm-hmm. You know, I just don't want to listen. I'm not interested.
Yeah.
Walk on by.
Yeah, that brings to mind, actually, I was reading a review of a film called Heaven Knows What by the Safdie brothers, which is about a young couple who are drug dependent. Someone, you know, they're filmmakers I really like, and I wanted to check out the film, but it's, this, I think he might have been a professor, but he was talking about, in talking about the film and the couple and their bond, which is a very dysfunctional bond, similar to Nessa and Blaise. He was describing the difference of basically people who live on the margins, because you're isolated from normal social relationships in a social circle, that you become, which is a healthy thing, you know, I guess in a normal situation you have many different healthy relationships, and that's a normal social life, but when you're someone who lives on the margins of society, that you don't have that, so you become over dependent on single things, like maybe a drug or a person,
just the idea of some other addiction.
Yeah. But that idea of how people on the margins maybe are more prone to end up in codependent, toxic relationships because they just don't have a world or options to bond with things in a healthier way. So they become over-dependent on things, or almost like end up in an addictive relationship, or, you know, an addicted to a substance. And that makes a lot of sense to me, where I'm from in Cape Breton. It's like I live on an island, and it's like there's an island complex, I think, which is sort of ties back to that you're naturally just more isolated. And
no man is an island.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
But I think it can sort of lead to some of those problems, because we do have these core needs to bond and things in relationships.
Well, and I think
it does come back to that.
I mean, I Blaise and Vanessa, I want to know what, you know, we get to meet her mother. I want to know a lot more about what's going on there, you know, before. What happened? What preceded? Mm-hmm. What wasn't done?
Yeah.
What were the gaps, the emotional gaps, the relational gaps that led them to this place, you know, that, and how could have we as a community, as individuals, as a society, I don't know, intervened in some way. And maybe, and I know people, friends of mine are listening right now laughing, going, yep, there's Peck the idealist again, right? But I don't know, you gotta be hopeful, it seems to me, right? In that pivot of your, professorial pivot.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm glad that the film is sparking those sorts of
ideas. Yeah.
Because I think, again, if we can just talk about them, I don't feel like I have the answers.
Yeah,
Those are questions that I ask myself too all the time. But I don't know what the fixes are, and I wish I knew. And I wish that
they're not
in
easy,
my own
right?
community, that we could just do things
turn on a switch.
Yeah.
How come we don't see too many other faces in the film? I don't think we do anyway.
We see lots of Blaze, lots of Vanessa. Yeah, no, some Blaze are the main characters, and the frame lingers on them, and everyone else is more in the off-screen space. And I think it makes sense for these two characters to just focus on them, because the film is about them, and because the simple reason that I chose not to shoot in a classical way,
right,
which would be a wide shot where maybe you'd see the two people in the room,
yep,
and then you move before you move into a close-up, or if we're both sitting here and we're talking, you'd do a shot, reverse shot, it would go to you, it would go to me. For me, I'm like, I chose not to shoot it classically, so then when I made that choice to do more singular, take a singular perspective on a scene, I'm gonna put the camera on the main character. I'm not gonna put it on, you know, someone who's the film's not about. So it just, in that way, just the style sort of ended up focusing on the main characters more. But I think also it just speaks to the characters, and I think that when you're in a situation like them, and your world sort of shrinks, like, they're just trying to survive, and I think their life is probably a lot different than most people's, because it is just a struggle to survive. And I think that when your world shrinks like that, and that's probably what it feels like. I don't know, but I think I'm hoping that it does capture somewhat the immediacy and the claustrophobia of what it's like when you're, you know, trying to figure out your basic needs every day,
and the loneliness of it, right?
Yeah,
the sense of just being. Everyone's against me.
Yeah.
And that's certainly Blaze's kind of presupposition, his approach to life.
Yeah.
Tell me about the clothesline. Why is that so important in this film? And I mean, the opening shot and how you hold on it and the big knot, and maybe we're tipping our hats too much, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, it comes back at the end of the film as well, the clothesline. So it's sort of like just a very gentle, the film opens with a scene that really chronologically would be at the end of the film. So I linger on it in some ways, because I, you know, it is sort of coming full circle, the film. But again, I was always just shooting things that felt like they meant something to me, and now when I look back at it, I see the clothesline, and I see the grinder that Nessa grinds Oreos in, and you know, the knot in the rope, like, the knot for me is, again, a bond, a connection between things,
A broken bond.
Yeah.
In a sense, right?
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, and Blaze also, they siphon gas from cars to put in their lawnmower, and, you know, they have a tube that they siphon gas with, and, you know, at one point in the film, he takes it and puts it around his neck and tightens it, you know, and starts choking himself, and... Yeah, and there's also a bike tire that he's spinning at one time.
Right.
And
there,
I don't know, there is definitely, I think, certain images, I think, in the film that do reoccur and become sort of motifs.
They definitely do. They're deeply existential. I mean, the Oreos, the drudgery of it, the sameness, right? Day in, day out.
Yeah.
Well, this is Sisyphus, isn't it?
Yeah.
Isn't this Camus again, sort of
bubbly? So.
I think it is, too. I love the fact that you had a script, and last night, and we're going to have to wrap it up here in a second, but last night in Q&A, and you kind of were very sort of playful with, well, you know, we had this, and we tried to shoot it, but then we just kept the camera rolling, and I think you were really, I guess, and this is the sign to me of a great director and a filmmaker, paying attention, right? And listening. Mm, listening to what was going on around you.
No, that is sums it up for me. That's as a director, or I think maybe any artist, that's usually what it's all about, is just like paying attention. That's what it was like. It was like, yeah, we'd set up a scene, but then when the actors would go on break while we're, you know, changing batteries or something, they're sitting off. It's just about having our eyes open and being really observant to everything, you know, every moment, not just the moment that you scripted. Like, the person when you're shooting a scene, the person who walks down the street that maybe you want to run after and ask them if they want to, you know, do a scene or something, just because, I mean, it's life that is inspiring all these things, and it's fun to just take things in and go towards the things that interest you. And
well, without a doubt, you are an attentive filmmaker for sure. Werewolf is the film. We're here with Ashley McKenzie at the Toronto International Film Festival. Thanks and congratulations again. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, that was a great conversation. Thank you.